Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. All right, we're ready to go.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Okay, all right. My interview is with vibraphonist Dan McCarthy. His self-release, Songs of the Doom, Some Jaded Atavistic Freakout, music inspired by the writings of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, was released on November 11th. So I want to thank you, Dan, for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So my first encounter with Thompson was through his 1971 novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It was a book on my uncle's shelf. I had no idea what I was reading, and I just kept rolling. I did enjoy the 1998 film adaptation of the book, but again, I really didn't understand what I was supposed to understand. Now, knowing more about him since his death in 2005, I kind of understand his work. My question to you is, how would you describe your first encounter with journalist and author Hunter S. Thompson?
Yeah, I love that question. I think that I came upon him much like most do, just like you did, through Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. The Vegas book is well, I mean, without a doubt, his most well-known book. I mean, it's regarded as probably one of the pieces of literature to best epitomize the 60s, you know, sort of transition into the 70s and kind of the, you know, peace and love generation kind of dying away. And I mean, his whole theme in that book and really in his entire career deals with the death of the American dream. And that tends to be very prominent throughout that book. So I was living in Toronto. It was probably, I don't know, 98, 99, I was working at Chapters Bookstore, which is a big chain, and came across the book and decided to read it. And like any, you know, late teen, early 20s kid, I was like, wow, this is hilarious. And, you know, it was just all of the things you would want. It was hilarious and exciting and to your point, kind of confusing. And I wasn't sure what I was supposed to get from it either. But his writing style just really... It took hold of me there, and I don't think it's let go since.
Yeah. I don't know when I read that book. I mean, I was really young. I think I was a preteen when I found the book.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was really, really confusing to me. But by the way, I thought it was brilliant of you to use Thompson's familiar script in sections of the liner notes of the release. Even the cover art conveys Thompson's gonzo journalism style. Who did the cover art?
Yeah, that really initially started off with my wife. Who also sings on the album. She sings on White Rabbit, but she was just sort of playing around with an idea. I knew that I really wanted to make sure that the art for this album was reflective of the music. I mean, anyone familiar with Thompson's work knows how much he worked with illustrator Ralph Steadman, and sort of the two of them together. I mean, that's sort of what makes Fair Living in Las Vegas, I think, as easy to picture as a book can be because of those drawings that Steadman did. And so I actually reached out to Ralph via email to ask if he would be open to actually write, like, drawing something for the cover, which, you know, he didn't know me. And of course, I'm sure he gets those kinds of requests all the time. So he said no. So, you know, we just started playing around with stuff, and my wife really came up with the initial design. And, you know, we had some help, of course, from professional designers to kind of help us kind of get to where it was. But really kind of her initial thought is essentially what it is there. And so it was just meant to be all kinds of things, the paint splatters, the craziness, the weirdness, and then kind of hidden throughout that image are a bunch of little Easter egg images sort of that represent Hunter's writing, or some of the music from Gary Burton that inspired the instrumentation in some of the writings. There's a lot of little kind of hidden imagery on that cover as well.
Yeah, I really like it. Now that should be a t-shirt.
There we go. I'm not opposed to that.
The definition of gonzo journalism is an unconventional style of journalism that relies on the reporter's personal involvement in the story and without claims of objectivity. Is this how you would describe the style of this release and the title of this release?
Whew, great question. I think that there would definitely be some parallels towards that. I mean, Hunter's writing was, I don't think any, like, gonzo journalism, I think, is something that other people will try to mimic or try to write. I don't think anyone will ever write it. I think anyone that tries to write like Hunter will just come off sounding contrived, like they're just trying to be someone that's such an original that created his own style. He never once, to your point, never once claimed that anything, you know, that he was trying to be, you know, sort of just reporting the truth. I think there's one quote where he was talking about Edward Muskie. This was during the 72 election of George McGovern, or I guess it would have been the Democratic nomination before the full election, but he was talking about Muskie, and he was, you know, he'd reported that there was a rumor had been started that Muskie was on this drug called Ibogaine. And then he goes on to say, he's like, well, and granted, I started that rumor, but it wasn't incorrect that I said that. And I think that really kind of epitomizes his style of writing. I think it was George McGovern's campaign manager that said that his book, Fair and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72, was the least factual but most accurate portrayal of the 1972 election, which I think is another great way of sort of putting his writing. He makes things up, he exaggerates, he creates these caricatures, but it's to prove a point. It's to kind of get to the actual truth, which I think a lot of journalists do the opposite. They focus on sort of these inconsistent truths that don't actually get to the point, whereas he focused on all the other stuff to prove the point. Drawing that back to the music, I do think that what I was trying to do with this music was to create something that would be, if Hunter listened to it today, he would appreciate that. I don't honestly don't care if it's not appreciated by the critics or by fans. I think that anyone that understands Hunter will appreciate this music on a level that most others won't. Now, I would love it if people actually like the music as well and want to, don't get me wrong, but my goal with this was to create something that was similar to Hunter's ethos, and I think we did it.
Songs of the Doomed, some jaded atavistic freakout. Music inspired by the writings of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. Now, I found out what he's a doctor of. He's a doctor of divinity.
Sure is.
Yeah, he did it mail-in.
Yep.
So I think that speaks to his creativity, shall we say?
Absolutely.
But that's a great title. Are we all doomed? Is that what you're telling us?
The title, a lot of his books were compilations of articles that he wrote, and one of the books was called Songs of the Doomed. And when I saw that, the first time I saw it, I didn't think to actually create music from it. But when I had this idea to start creating music based on his writing, I didn't even have to think about what the name of the band would be called or what the sort of project would be called. Songs of the Doomed just it struck me and there was no conversation to be had. It really, that in and of itself creates such imagery in your head. I think that it's just such powerful, you know, four words, but it really, everyone will think of something, but everyone will think of something different. So that's sort of where that part came from. Some jaded atavistic freakout is actually a quote from one of the, well, what an article that he wrote for Scanlon's magazine when he was covering the Kentucky Derby in 1970, which was actually the first time he met Ralph Steadman. They were there in his hometown of Louisville. He hadn't been back for a long time. And, you know, in typical Hunter fashion, they were trying to cover the real story, not the race, but kind of he wanted to find, like, he was far more interested in the people that would show up. And he goes to great detail. But at one point, he's talking about this guy that was in the bar when he got there, and he was just some crazy drunk person that was there to get his, you know, have a great time in this jaded atavistic freakout. And I just thought, wow, he has such a way with words sometimes. And so I was like, absolutely. That's such, again, with the great imagery and kind of interesting wordplay, just again, four words, but some jaded atavistic freakout, just, it's like, what does that even mean? Like, atavistic is such a word. Like, nobody even, you know, no one uses the word atavistic in regular speech these days, though Hunter used it quite a bit. And so I knew that I had the album title and the song title right there.
And the band, the rest of the members of the group, what was their take on Thompson?
Yeah, it was interesting because some of them had experience reading and watching the movie. Others had never sort of read a word or seen the movie and didn't really know much about it. I did make sure that when we went to do the recording, we did 2 days of recording and we stayed overnight at the studio. I made sure to bring I think I brought the DVD, but I think we ended up renting it on Netflix or something. And we all watched together, sort of just drinking some beers and watching it between sessions. And I think that really helped, like, because the people that hadn't really seen it definitely started to understand where some of the song titles come from and where some of the, you know, the ideas for this and just the why it's sort of as weird as it is. So that was definitely it. But I mean, it was such a blast, even from like our very first rehearsal when I first put this together with them. Everyone seemed very into it. They were very excited about the music and they really enjoyed it. And I think we all knew that we had a really special project that we're going to be working on.
I'd like to talk to you as a musician. My father felt that I should have started out on piano. And after that, he said, you can learn any instrument you want. Well, after violin and guitar, I ended up as a French horn major in college. As a professional vibraphonist, what instrument would you recommend as a prerequisite to playing the vibraphone or any other mallet percussion instrument?
Yeah, I mean, I think your dad was right. Piano would be absolutely the right way to approach it. I think that approaching the vibes from a pianistic point of view versus a percussive point of view just gives you a much better way of looking at harmonies and how to play. Probably the teacher that I've looked up to the most, that I've learned the most from throughout my years, in terms of like specifically learning vibraphone, is a professor at Berklee School of Music named Ed Sandin. Ed is a wonderful, do you know Ed? He's a wonderful, wonderful human.
Ed has been at Berklee College of Music for what, 30, 40 years?
He studied with Gary Burton in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he's been teaching there ever since. So he's as Berklee as you can get. Wonderful human being, just one of the greatest people to talk to. And he's such a great teacher. And his approach is very pianistic. And, you know, I've taken lessons on and off with him for many years. And we would often sort of talk about piano and approaching how to, you know, how to play chords and how to comp on piano and how that translates to the vibraphone. So I think that absolutely piano is a wonderful tool to help you, sort of understand and see how the vibes work.
All right. Let me switch gears for a minute. I'd like to end with this quote from author and educator William McKean. This is right from the liner notes of the release. "Odd, isn't it, that Hunter S. Thompson rarely wrote about music? He worked for Rolling Stones. He consorted with the Rolling Stones and once shared airspace with Bob Dylan. Yet when we think about Hunter, we think about politics, motorcycle gangs, and hot tub romps with porn stars. But think of an iceberg. What we see when we look at Hunter's work is the part that's above the surface. Down below lies the research, the inspiration, and the music. There was rhythm and music in his writing, but it's not obvious at first. To Hunter, music was fuel. He played it loud with superb stereo equipment. Though he could be technologically challenged, he cared deeply about having the right kind of speakers and a good amp." My question to you is, how do you relate to Keane's description of Thompson's consumption of music as fuel?
As much as possible, I relate. It's something that I have on all the time, whether I'm upstairs drinking coffee in the morning and having a conversation with my wife, whether I'm down in my office working, music is always, always on. We're in the car driving, it's on. Like we have a almost 5-year-old, and I mean, he's been listening to music since he was born. You know, he's actually, it's really cute because he's able to sing along to, you know, a lot of songs at this point now, which is pretty great. But it's music has always had the ability to, I guess, invoke emotions that nothing else has been able to do. It's been able to, it inspires, it definitely fosters creativity. It can make you sit back and think, it can give you energy, it can make you excited. And I think that, you know, when you actually take the time to sit and listen and allow that music to wash over you, whatever that might be for you, you're energized. It's fuel. It drives you to want to be better or want to do something, whatever that might be for you. And I know that was very much the way that it was for Hunter. He would need that to make sure that he was, you know, going and continuing and writing his best stuff. So I very much relate to that, because if I had to name one thing, you know, probably other than caffeine, that I would consider fuel, it would be absolutely music. I couldn't work without it.
And let me give you the last word, Dan. Is there something you'd like us to know about an upcoming project, an upcoming gig? I mean, as we're talking today, it's Thanksgiving here in the United States.
Yeah, I think that nothing specific coming up. I think that, you know, the only message that I'd want folks to sort of take from this is, despite the fact that Hunter was absolutely known for his drug abuse and alcoholism, and that's sort of what draws a lot of especially college age students to his writing in the first place, much like William McKean said, in terms of the iceberg, he was so much more than that. Like, that was such surface level, and that's sort of what got taken and exaggerated. But his ability to write, his ability to sort of discern fact from fiction in his own way in terms of politics, he truly is one of the best political writers we've had in the past 100 years. And I think that folks need to start looking at him more in terms of his contributions to literature, than just the sort of drug-addled, you know, crazy weirdo freak that everyone kind of sees him as. So he's far more than what people think he was. And I just would urge people to go out there and read some of his other stuff. You know, my recommendation would be to start with Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
For more information, vibraphonedan.com. Okay. And now for some holiday music.
I don't have to search too far for that holiday feeling, 'cause standing right outside my door, my heart's already reeling. Much like a Hallmark Christmas film, this town's got magic and charm. Could even fall in love today with that boy next door, Farmer. In the Christmas city, you'll feel grand. Might even catch a snowflake in your hand. Window shop on Main Street, take a carriage ride downtown, 'cause in the Christmas city, you are right where you belong. In the Christmas city, you'll understand why folks come far and wide to see firsthand the famous star high up on the hill, the glowing hotel lights. Yes, in the Christmas city, you can plan to stay a while. Is now my hometown with new traditions neath the evergreen. In the Christmas city, my home, where I missed the signs and tried to roam. This whole town's my special place to celebrate and embrace that in the Christmas city, I am right where I belong. that in the Christmas city we are right where we belong.
drummer and leader Joe McCarthy with the New York Afro-Bop Alliance Big Band from their September Angel Face release, The Pan American Nutcracker Suite. In the background, we just heard March. Before this, from his second holiday album, pianist and vocalist Doc Watkins and a full big band on one of the classics, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, from his release that's out now, Music of a Charlie Brown Christmas. And from her debut self-release EP, In the Christmas City, we heard the title tune by vocalist and songwriter Connie Mamana. You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. For more information about the show, jazzfluxus.com. And time for one more set of music.
Yo, that's literally what I said yesterday, and Adrian was like, wait till you see what we do tomorrow. He was not playing.
All right, ready?
You there.
Ready? One. We'll be right back. Thank you.
In the background, Where Grace Abounds by drummer Julius Rodriguez, also known as Orange Julius, from his Verve release of this year, Let Sound Tell All. On November 4th, he released a deluxe edition of the album. Before this, a solo piece from the Jammin' Colors 2022 release, Black Lives, From Generation to Generation. That was from one of the contributing artists, guitarist Marvin Sewell, with Hero's Journey. the group Anthropoda with their latest single from the Tiny Room Sessions on Tiny Records. We heard the tune Organized Crime. And we started off with vibraphonist turned pianist Garrett Saracho, an artist whose solo release from the 70s and Medio was pushed to the wayside. Now he's found himself working with the duo behind the label Jazz is Dead. From Jazz is Dead 15 by Saracho, we listen to Kahlo. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced for and airing on WGXC 90.7 FM, a listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host the Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WGXC. WGXC.org. For more information about Situation Fluxus, TheJazzDisturbance at gmail.com or jazzfluxus.com. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your holiday week and weekend.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.